Welcome to the show. I'm Jordan Harbinger. As always, I'm here with producer Jason DeFilippo. On the Jordan Harbinger Show, we decode the stories, secrets, and skills of the world's most brilliant and interesting people and turn their wisdom into practical advice that you can use to impact your own life and those around you. Mubin Sheikh is a Canadian intelligence, or CSIS, agent who infiltrated and successfully foiled a crazy terror plot in Canada, where a group known as the Toronto 18 planned to hold Parliament hostage and behead the Prime Minister. Before foiling Canada's September 11th, he was a bit of a radical himself, even traveling to Syria to do a deep dive into hardline Islam. Today on the show, we'll follow Mubin on his journey from an average Canadian teenager to radical Islamic militant, all the way to undercover counter-terror agent, and get a glimpse into the world of online terror recruiting and radical extremism. This is a fascinating trip and something we rarely get to examine up close, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. By the way, I met Mubin through my network. In fact, a CIA agent or former CIA agent introduced us, so that was kind of cool. I would love to teach you how to create and maintain networks like mine. I want to do it for free because the more people that know this stuff, the better. I've got a course on how to do this. 6-Minute Networking is what it's called, and it's free for you at jordanharbinger.com/course. And by the way, most of the guests on the show actually subscribe to the course and the newsletter. So come join us. You'll be in great company. All right, here's Mubin Sheikh. So the term radicalization is, unfortunately, it's trending. And I want to know what that means from somebody who's kind of been in there, because I feel like it gets thrown around a lot. It's in danger of maybe losing a lot of the meaning that it has.
Yeah, that's good to start with, actually. Radicalization is the normal human psychological process whereby people become increasingly extreme in their views. So it is a process. And the end of that process is that you become an extremist. You accept that violence or violent acts in the public space are acceptable. And if you act on that, then you're a violent extremist. You could have a process of radicalization which does not end in violence, and then you could have what is called violent radicalization, or you could have, you know, gone through a process of violent radicalization which does end in violence.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
Process whereby people become increasingly extreme in their views.
I can agree with that. I mean, not that I would disagree with your definition anyway, but it does make sense because you see nonviolent and you don't think of radicals as nonviolent. We only kind of really hear about them in the news. But yeah, when I go on, not Reddit, but like if I ever look at 4chan or whatever over a friend's shoulder, if you know what that is, it's like, yeah, one of those dark webby type places. You see people on there and you're like, oh, this person is a toxic mess, or this group of people is horrible and toxic. That, I guess, is radicalization. They're just not doing anything about it, thankfully.
Yeah, and we don't want to make the implication that radicalization equals violent. Just like radicals that we know even in our popular culture, Martin Luther King Jr., he was radicalized. He was a radical in that sense. He wasn't violent. And then you'll have others who have crazy ideas, and they'll just promote those ideas, but they won't actually act on them.
Right. So yeah, that's probably fortunate for a lot of us.
That's what we prefer, yeah.
Yeah. Were you a recruiter for one of these organizations, or was that just something that somebody said?
No, I gave da'wah to, so I gave invitation towards, and that's what we would call recruiting, towards supporting this global jihadi culture, not necessarily a specific group, because that global jihadi culture incorporates within it all the groups, Taliban, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and so on.
Okay, so you were kind of just like,
so I was a supporter.
I support that. Join somebody.
Right.
I don't have any particular recommendations.
Right.
Yeah. Why didn't you pick one group? Not that I'm criticizing your
radical recruiting. I actually did, because in 1996, because my radicalization period really ran from 95 to, let's say, 2001. But I was kind of on my way off that ramp by 1998 after I got married. But in 1996 is when the war in Chechnya kicked off. And that was the spot that I would always think about wanting to go to as a foreign fighter. I did focus on one, and that was Chechnya, but there were other, you know, arenas that were being promoted just the same.
So you met your wife in like 98 or something like that?
No, I met her in high school in 92.
What?
Right? 92, 93.
So this radicalization thing was like a big parabolic phase in your life, because your wife is like very, she's Polish, right? And very, do not look directly at her because she's so white, right?
So glow in the dark white.
Right. And so in high school, you must have been able to relate to women like that. Yeah. And then now you're able to relate to women like that. But during this phase where you're like, okay, super Muslim, she wasn't, so...
It's so weird how it happened, because I met her in high school, and, you know, we were metalheads, so everyone, like, our friend circles crossed. And then in 95, I have this house party, it gets raided by my uncle, and then I go away to India and Pakistan to get super religious. And then when I come back is when she realizes, wait a second, what made this guy go from this all the way to this? And so that sparked more interest. And then we were just talking, you know, really, like, we weren't dating. We didn't even, like, I didn't even make up with her, man, before, you know, like, we were just kind of hanging out. And then she was wondering, like, why, what is this guy hanging out with me for? Like, what does he want?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, man, like, how can I get this girl? Like, how can I fit her into my worldview where I'm supposed to be married and she has to be Muslim? Like, how do I do that? So somehow I did. I convinced her, or she accepted to marry me. And then, you know, that was 20 years ago.
Wow. Five kids. So something's working.
Something's definitely working.
Yeah. Okay. So let's back up a little, because I know you went to public high school, but you also went to this, like, kind of strict Islamic school. So you had two lives as a kid.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like, being, you know, growing up in Canada, obviously you're going to public school. That's the expectation. And by evening, in the evening time, so from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m., I'll never forget, you went to Quran school.
Every day?
Every day. Every day. Seven days a week.
7 days a week?
Yeah.
It's horrible.
You know, so, I mean, they say even God rested on the seventh, not us.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, keep going, man.
Keep going. Break. Get some catching up to do.
Yeah. So it was 2 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it was a complete contrast to the caring, nurturing environment of public school. This was the hard, austere, stereotypical madrasa, which just, I mean, in Arabic just means school, but its connotation is, you know, this India or Pakistan or Afghanistan, you know, boys, you know, sitting on the floor, rocking back and forth, reading the Quran, not understanding what they're reading.
So you're just reading it in Arabic, I guess?
And just reading it in Arabic. It's so weird the way they do it, because they basically teach you how to read it in transliteration, right? So if I was to, you know, write out English letters to sound out, you know, the Arabic, right? So like Allah is A-L-L-A-H.
Oh, so you're reading like Romanized.
So we're reading Arabic, but we're only being taught how to recite. We're not being taught what it means.
Mm-hmm. It's rote memorization.
And that's a big problem across the Muslim world even today.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a little bit. Oh, we kind of talked about that outside, actually. So this house party, it sounds like you were more or less a normal teenager. You got some metal, some rock and roll.
The devil's music. Yeah, it was last year of high school. You know, I had already grown up going to house parties, so I kind of got the hang of it.
Yeah.
You know, so I just invited everyone over. And, you know, this is before social media, right? So it's like it spreads by word.
Yeah.
And it spreads fast, right? Like, it's not as fast as social media, but still, when you hear there's a house party happening, you go, right? My parents were out of town. I had the house party. It was so rocking. And
until
that, you know, stereotypical, meanie, scowling Muslim dude who happened to be my father's older brother burst through the door like a SWAT team. Like he like the door flew open, slammed against the wall, and like everybody just like, you know, just the color just drained from their faces in that split second as they also
jet out
the side doors. People were literally jumping off the second floor balcony onto the, it was wild.
Traditional, like,
Yes. You can imagine the long,
like, what's going on, dude?
You can imagine the long white robe, you know, flopping back and forth, and it's like, oh, crap.
And he's yelling, obviously.
Oh,
the whole time. He's losing it.
He's losing it.
Because
I have defiled the house, right?
Oh, you're not allowed to have
these, you know, kuffar, these non-Muslim, these infidel kids who are, you know, defiling the place with their very presence.
Yeah.
And also with the beer bottles and the joints.
Yeah, sure.
And that didn't help. And so it was a huge crime in his eyes.
You must have felt horrible. I mean, I assume that you got it from everybody in the family for the next month and a half or more.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, he got on the phone, he's calling for backup, you know, he's trying to get the other uncles to come by, and I'll be honest, like, there was a stolen car in the garage.
No!
You know, it was a wild house party, all right? And these guys, man, they just jacked his car, and they put it in the garage, and I took off that night, because, like, I panicked. And then, like, I had these guys basically trying to get in touch and saying, yo, dude, like, we got a car in the garage. And so later I learned that they went to the house. My uncles were all there. And the uncles didn't want anything to do with it. So they're just like, take the car and get out.
Wow. They're like, excuse me, we have to get our car. And they're like, no. And they're like, we stole it. And they're like, all right, fine, go.
That's exactly what happened.
Oh, man.
They did say, no, it's a stolen car. They're like, okay, take it
out. In that case, get it out of my house now.
Do it now. Yeah.
Oh, wow. What? Okay. So then you'd mentioned, okay, you decided to get more religious, because I can see your logic
it's
here.
The guilt trip. The guilt trip really made me feel so bad about what I had done that the only way for me to salvage this is to, quote unquote, get religious.
Yeah, I can totally understand the thought process. Like, okay, if I want them to stop yelling at me, I need to double down on everything they want, which is be super religious and conservative, because I'll feel better about myself and they'll get off my case.
Right.
Like, I completely
typical
follow
kid
that
logic,
but I follow that logic. I understand that. I get it.
Right.
Okay. So what is your first step then? You go study Quran more with your uncles and you're just like, show me the ways. And then ... what happened? You end up in
a
different place.
Yeah. So I ended up joining a group. It's like a proselytizing fundamentalist group. They don't try to convert other people. They try to encourage other Muslims to become more observant.
Okay.
Okay. So it's a little different. And they offer this training, if you will, like let's call it an immersion program, where it's for 4 months, 2 months in India, 2 months in Pakistan. And it's even more austere than backpacking, because you're literally staying in the mosque, you're cooking your own food, you're just like really living very, very basic. And all you're doing is just self-indoctrinating in these ways. And it's praying and it's reading Quran. But none of it is actually studious in the sense, like, you're still not learning what the Arabic actually says. So I would have to go to an English translation to kind of understand what I was reading, let's say. So it was less intellectual and more behavioral, like, more devotional.
Sure. I could. Yeah, that makes sense. You're almost programming yourself. You're not learning to, like, think critically about the stuff you're reading and ask questions.
Just blind following.
That's that's... So that's what they consider to be more observant. Not to learn it, but to memorize it, basically.
Yeah, to go through the motions, right? Yikes. To play the part, to look the part.
That makes sense. I mean, we see that in other religions, too.
Yeah.
You know, you see it with that, what's that crazy church where they protest soldiers' funerals and stuff?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. The
Westboro Baptist
Church.
Clearly, those people haven't, like, looked at a Bible and gone, oh, you know what? This is clearly the interpretation. They're just like, I'm going to memorize whatever our crazy grandpa or whatever guy, whoever's the leader of that, is saying. So how did you end up starting to get radicalized? Because there's a difference between memorizing things and going to the worst backpacker hostel ever in Pakistan with a bunch of other people, and then being like, I got to take action in this completely violent and unreasonable way.
Mm-hmm. That's a good distinction to make, because, again, most people who do get radicalized don't become violent. And for me, what had happened is, now that I am in Pakistan, we were sent to a city called Quetta. And for those who do know, in the mid-90s, Quetta was the stronghold of this newly formed Taliban movement. So, you know, if you remember, 79 to 89, the Soviets were in Afghanistan. They fought it out. The Mujahideen, quote-unquote, they were the good guys at this time. Then there was a five-year civil war after that. And then by 95, the Taliban have come to power in Afghanistan. So I literally ended up walking into one of their areas, and it was a total chance encounter. It's not like I went and I joined the Taliban in Pakistan. That's not what happened. I went and with this group who happened to be in the same city with the Taliban, and then I went around just, you know, walking around. Like, part of our thing is to encourage other Muslims to be more observant.
Oh, so you're like looking for somebody
to talk to,
a cigarette or something,
exactly.
Hanging out.
Yep. And we would say, brother, you know, we've come from Canada and blah, blah, blah. And
so, I came from Canada here to Pakistan. Let me teach you something about
being Muslim. Right, right,
yeah.
Exactly. You know how many people said that to us? They said, why are you here?
Yeah.
We're already Muslim. Like, beat it.
It's new for you.
Yeah,
that's not new for me.
Right. We've been here a little while.
Yeah. Know?
But, of course, there were also these Taliban members who were around, and I kind of chanced upon them. They were just kind of sitting around there. And the spiel that we would kind of give is, you know, to be successful in this life and the next life, you must follow the commandments of God as shown by the way of the Prophet, alayhi salam. And they said, look, one guy said, well, he goes, if you want to be successful in this life and the next, you do it with this. And he picked up the AK-47.
And that's kind of badass at that age, right?
That was the moment, because this Muslim kid who's seeking this new identity, who's kind of, you know, especially this identity of following the pure religious ways of however they perceive it, it all came together for me. This was an identity that I could buy into. And that's what happened to me is when I realized, yeah, you know what? Militancy is the way forward because it's strength. It's showing strength. And especially me, you know, this young Muslim kid coming from what I thought was a position of powerlessness. Now I belong to something much greater. Now I am more powerful.
Yeah, I can understand that. How old were you at this point?
18.
18. So 19. 100% get it. I can totally see myself falling into something like that, especially at that age, because you lack purpose at that age.
Right.
And you're kind of being treated as a kid by your parents, maybe society, but you're biologically an adult, but you got nothing really going on. You're like maybe still in high school. So then it's September 11, 2001 or September 10, 2001. You said that was your last day as an extremist. What happened?
Yeah, and I mean, 9/11 happened. It was Tuesday morning. I was driving to work. I heard a plane hit the building. I was like, oh my God, you know, I actually said Allahu Akbar, you know, which contrary to what people think doesn't mean I'm about to blow myself up. You know, a lot of times it does also mean, oh my God. And then just the events of that day, watching it on TV, everybody kind of sharing in that collective trauma. And then later that day, going to see the bad friends that I was hanging out with because I had left the group that I was initially with and then kind of came back and joined up with more extreme, more politically vocal, what they call Salafists or Wahhabis. They were just a lot more in tune with the geopolitical situation. And so I remember one friend of mine and my friend asked, you know, I was like, yeah, but I understand fighting the cause and, you know, in combat, how do you justify flying planes into buildings? These are not combatants. These are not military targets. Like, and there was a pause, right? And it's never just one moment, okay? But that was a moment that really struck me because, you know, the guy paused trying to come up with an answer and then ended up saying, well, they're all infidels anyway, so it doesn't matter. And then both my friend and I, we turned to each other with that, that doesn't jive.
Nah.
And so that's when I realized that I didn't know Arabic. I needed to study it properly and formally. And then I would decide to undertake a trip to Syria in 2002. To do just that.
Yeah, I can understand this. I mean, your friends and family were already telling you things like extremism is toxic, right? Like your parents and uncles, even the guy who probably kicked down the door of your house party was probably like, whoa, man, calm down.
Yeah.
So I wonder what he felt. He was probably like, man, this is partly my fault.
Well, it's funny because a lot of these people didn't know that I had this change of heart.
They didn't.
And it's when I started to make known my intention that I'm going to Syria. Everybody was like, oh, crap. Oh, boy. You know, we've heard of this. But it wasn't like that, right? And I mean, and even though when I got there, one of the first things I actually did was register with the Canadian embassy, right?
Just in case something
just
happens.
Just in case, right? Which worked out a little bit later. I'm sure we'll get into that. But it ended up working in my favor anyway. Then the war in Iraq kicked off in 2003. And I watched as the Syrian regime sent students in air-conditioned buses to go and join the fight against the Americans. I was invited to go, of course. You know, thank God I didn't go.
They just sent over, like, people studying anthropology or whatever. And
not quite anthropology. Okay. It was an Islamic university.
Okay.
Definitely Islamic university. I could see there were some really shady people there. Like, quite a few of them did end up going, and none of them came back.
Yeah, so, I can imagine that Iraq isn't like, well, we better save these foreign fighters for later. They're like, oh, you're going to show up here? Go ahead.
That's right.
Save our own boys for wave two.
We'll kill the Americans. That was, as far as the Syrians were concerned, they didn't care.
Yeah, ugh, yuck. You don't hear about too many people going to Syria to get de-radicalized, though.
Not today.
No.
Obviously, not since 2010 when the civil war began and the atrocities by the Assad regime, you know, are now... Nobody in their right mind would go there for this sort of stuff.
No. But Syria is more, with the under Assad, is mostly secular, right? Or kind of, not secular, but not extreme.
Yeah, I would call it authoritarian secularism.
Yeah.
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 So they are that, yes, but they're just incredibly authoritarian, which...
I heard you mention that you'd said something like, yeah, we're all online complaining about how Canada's turning into a police state. But then you went to Syria and you're like, oh, okay. This is what a police state is really like.
Yeah,
got it.
Yeah.
So what are you talking about when you say that? Like what's
yeah,
going
it was,
on?
It was really just the disillusionment I felt while I was there in Syria, like studying and being this Westerner and really being this kid who was trying to like force this costume onto himself. And now I'm referring to myself in the third person.
That's fine. Yeah, no problem.
But that's basically what happened. You know, they just kind of, it didn't work because I was still in a very idealized state. especially coming out of the West, Canada in particular, where you can wear whatever you want and you have a right to do that. And if anyone questions you, you stand up and you tell them you're right. But in Syria, it's not like that. You don't do that. And people didn't look like me, right? Like giant beards were frowned upon, right? The government would actually tell people to come and trim your beard if it was too long.
Really?
Because they consider that a sign of extremism. But I was a foreigner, so nobody was going to tell me that. In fact, I was told that, but by the Islamic school teacher.
Oh, wow.
Which really made me like, I thought to myself, how dare he? You know, this is like the beard, like the prophet had a beard, so I got to have a beard. And it's like, you know, later on, people ended up telling me, it's like, well, you know, the prophet also rode a camel, so where's yours, buddy?
Yeah.
You know, so.
I guess they probably tell you to do that because they don't want to be on the radar of the police either.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, again, that whole back to that police state concept, you know, everybody is, you know, if they're not passively informing on you, they're actively informing on you. But I wasn't up to anything nefarious while I was there. And I mean, I was an open book and they could see what I was doing and everything was fine. But of course, I'll never forget walking by the Mukhabarat, which is the secret police. And I just waved to the guy and he replies to me, Walaikum Salam, Abu Mujahid.
Oh, he knew your name?
Yeah, I was like, what? He knew my name.
Wow.
I didn't know who he was.
Was he just standing outside the building?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. He was just standing there and he was like, hey, I'm a Mujahid.
Wow,
up?
He had memorized you. Wow, how many?
Well, there wasn't, like, I was living in a little town outside of Damascus, and it was just my wife and I,
okay.
And so they've never seen people
Your
like us.
Your wife lived in Syria, too.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, I didn't think about that.
Oh, yeah.
That makes sense, of course.
Yeah, we had two kids at the time.
Wow. She must have been like, what did I get myself into?
She's gung-ho. She's like, because when we got married in 98, we went on this crazy honeymoon trip. Like, we went to Israel/Palestine and did the Holy Land tour there and in India and Egypt and Saudi Arabia, like Mecca and Medina, like the religious sites. So she's very adventurous and she, you know, she's cool with that.
Mecca and Medina must be interesting. I will never experience firsthand, probably, but they look really interesting.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. It's the, you know, literalist readings that people have where, because in the ancient context, it was polytheists who kind of ran that area, and then they were basically taken over, if you will. I mean, the Muslims became powerful and dominant, and so the edict basically was, don't let non-Muslims into these holy cities. Now, you know, 1,500 years later, you know, where we have global transportation, and you have business people coming there to Jeddah, which is just like 30 minutes from Mecca. I mean, you can get that close, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But they've taken it really literally. And so they say, like, on the highway, it'll say Mecca this way, non-Muslims that way.
Yeah.
And it's got an arrow. But it's like, I don't know why. I don't know why they need to do that. I think they should open it up to people and just experience it because people want to, right?
I would check it out. Yeah, I had a friend invite me to Jeddah. I was like, oh, it's really close to, is it Mecca or Medina?
Yeah, to Mecca.
Yeah, and I was like, that would be so cool. And he goes, no, you need a special visa. And I go, well, how do I get it? And he goes, well, at first you convert to Islam. And I was like, that sounds like it's going to take a lot longer than waiting in line at the embassy.
Yeah.
Maybe we won't do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I could hook you up with like a certificate, a fake certificate.
That sounds like a terrible idea.
But you would be able to get in with it.
And I'd have to learn.
You wouldn't? No, I'd give you that, whatever.
Yeah.
But it's funny. Some people are like, you know, don't turn it into a tourist haven.
Yeah.
But it's like, have you seen the Muslims?
It's got to already be
have
a tourist haven.
Have you seen
haven?
The Muslims there? It's like, there's halal KFC, like right there. Like, I mean, like, and people flock to it.
Wow.
Halal McDonald's, halal Burger King. So it's like, you don't want to make it into a tourist haven.
You get like, you know how Starbucks has mugs from the different stores? Is there one that says like Mecca in the Starbucks?
No, I haven't seen that. I doubt they'd have that uncovered woman though on the cup.
Probably not.
Have to like black mark her out. Give her
it would
a veil.
Be the Starbucks gap, but with like a full niqab.
That's right.
They could do that. That might not have the same branding effects.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Mubin Sheikh. We'll be right back.
This episode is sponsored in part by ZipRecruiter. Hiring can be a slow process, and Cafe Altura's COO, Dylan Miskowitz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company.
but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants, so he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you, it finds them for you. It's got tech inside, as it always does. It identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job so you get qualified candidates fast. In other words, you're not just putting a job on a site and hoping that you don't get a bunch of crazies. It'll actually find, ZipRecruiter will actually go out and find them for you. So Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter, got some candidates quickly, and then he used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter the applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Jason?
See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Jordan. That's ZipRecruiter.com/JORDAN. ZipRecruiter.com/Jordan. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
This episode is also sponsored by Skillshare. Skillshare has been a sponsor of the show for a while, and they've got pretty much everything you could want to learn on there. Skillshare is an online learning community with thousands of amazing classes, and I mean everything. There's creative stuff, entrepreneurial skills are in there, photography, creative writing, design, productivity. Jason, what were you messing around with in there?
I was trying out Audition, but now I've moved over to Ableton because I'm trying to make me some EDM music just to, you know, kill the time at the end of the day instead of watching TV and mindlessly vegging out. I'm making some beeps and boops, and I'm learning how to do that on Skillshare.
Jen's taken a bunch of things in there from software for the business all the way to decorating and organizing and things like that. So it's been very useful for everyone adjacent to the Jordan Harbinger show. Whether you're looking to kill time or build some professional skills, that's what Skillshare is all about. Jason?
Join the millions of students already learning on Skillshare today with a special offer just for our listeners. Get 2 months of Skillshare for free. That's right, Skillshare is offering the Jordan Harbinger show listeners 2 months of unlimited access to thousands of classes for free. To sign up, go to Skillshare.com/Harbinger. Again, go to Skillshare.com/Harbinger to start your 2 months now. That's Skillshare.com/Harbinger. Thanks for listening and supporting the show. And to learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard from our amazing sponsors, visit JordanHarbinger.com/deals. Don't forget, we have a worksheet for today's episode so you can make sure you solidify your understanding of the key takeaways from Mubin Shake. That link is in the show notes at JordanHarbinger.com/podcast. If you'd like some tips on how to subscribe to the show, just go to JordanHarbinger.com/subscribe. Subscribing to the show is absolutely free. It just means that you get all the latest episodes downloaded automatically to your podcast player so you don't miss a single thing. And now back to our show with Mubin Shake.
All right. So you go to Syria. It's a real police state. How do you then become working with the Canadian CSIS, which is, I guess, the Canadian CIA kind of thing? Is that equivalent?
Well, it's a little bit.
FBI more like? I don't know.
Yeah. So basically what happens is I go through a period of de-radicalization while I'm in Syria. I'm introduced to the Sufi sect of Islam or the Sufi understanding of Islam. They're not a sect. It's more like an understanding. You know, the Sufis are like the Jedis of the Muslim world. And the Wahhabis are like the Sith. All right?
Oh,
best
okay.
analogy.
Gotcha.
Okay, we both draw from the Force, but one is dark side of the Force. So, you know, I de-radicalized while I was there. I realized that my interpretations were wrong. You know, I learned the history properly. I learned the prophetic traditions, went into the Quran in depth, and finally became so, like, almost depressed, you know, that I was in Syria. I was like, man, you know, I just want to go home, you know. And I had this newfound appreciation for the rights that we have in the West, at least in Canada anyway. And I can't really comment on the U.S. situation here right now.
Yeah. Can't throw stones in this glass house.
I finished my 2 years there. I gave up, you know, in the sense, because I had this idea that I was going to stay there for many, many years, and not realizing, of course, that, you know, the war that kicked off in 2010, God only knows what would have happened to me and my family if I was still there.
Man.
Yeah, I didn't want to think about it. I mean, the horrible videos that I saw already coming out online, I couldn't imagine if I was still there. Guaranteed I would have been killed.
Yeah, you would have
by,
gotten...
By the regime. Yeah. I would have been tortured for years and then hopefully killed. So basically, I come back in 2004 to Canada. And the first week that I'm back, the first Canadian has been arrested on terrorism charges, the post-9/11 terrorism charges. Mu'min Khawaja was arrested in connection with the 2004 London fertilizer bomb plot. It was the plot before the subway bombings. Momin Khawaja sat beside me in that Quran school I went to as a kid.
Oh, wow.
In Canada. We used to play Hot Wheels cars together.
Jeez.
Right? He lived on the 8th floor, apartment 808. I picked up the phone, and you remember once upon a time they had phone books?
Yeah, vaguely. Yeah.
So I basically found the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, and I called him up, and I said, hey, I know this guy, I know the family, and they're like, oh, you know him. Okay, well, I mean, then someone's going to come and have a chat with you if that's okay.
Yeah, don't move.
Just where are you going to be in the next hour and a half, is what he said. So basically the intelligence officer came, I told him my whole life story again, and he just basically put to me the prospect of consulting for them. In an undercover capacity and basically guiding them as to who's the good guy and who's the bad guy.
Wow, that was fast. They must have already checked you out if they did that.
I would hope so. I mean, I think, though, they did see the value that I brought because I had the ability to access those vulnerable communities or those specific targets that they had in mind. They knew I could get next to those people without any problem.
Sure.
Because if people did back check me, which they did, you know, I remember coming to one place and the guy was like, oh, yeah, we did a credit check on you. Everything checked out.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, credit check? Oh.
Oh, that kind of credit.
Right.
Street cred. Yeah, not Equifax you have up there.
Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting. I wonder how they do that. They just go, oh, where'd you study? Oh, that? All right, who do we know that was there? Who knows this Abu?
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Mobine guy.
That's right. It's exactly what they did, both from the government side and the bad guy side. You know, for the government, it was, okay, check if this guy registered with the embassy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, sure enough, he did.
How do you know that was what How do you know that was what did it, though? They tell you?
They told me. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He told me straight. Basically, what he said was your background check would have taken much longer had you not registered with the embassy. Because then what they do is they then ask the local Syrian police to go and find out what was this guy doing, who was he with. What town was he living in? Who was he studying with?
Sure.
This and that.
So they're cooperating. So, like, hey, just make sure this guy, for your sake and ours, that this guy's not getting radicalized right now.
That's right.
Oh, that's interesting.
It worked out for me because I was de-radicalizing, right, at that point.
Because it would have been tough for them to call Syria after and be like, do you have any info on this guy?
Yeah.
Maybe. What's it to you? Yeah, tit for tat. Okay, so you're kind of trying to go undercover, or actually, you're trying to vouch for your old friend who turns out to actually be
a bad guy.
Yeah. So what were you like? No, he's fine. And like, here's all the evidence. You're like, never mind.
Yeah. Well, it was more, they were basically saying, look, you know, it's out of our hands, his case, because the police lay charges. And the way it works in Canada is the security intelligence component is done by CSIS. The federal policing bit is done by the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. In the US, the FBI does both.
Okay, got it.
The CIA does what's called foreign intelligence collection. Canada does not have a foreign collection of intelligence.
At all?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
We do piggyback off of allies, Five Eyes,
mm-hmm.
what's called the ABCA Alliance, America, Britain, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And we do kind of piggyback off of that with liaison officers, but we don't have a dedicated agency to do that, like the CIA
or
even the Australians actually have. ASIO, Australian Security Intelligence Organization.
You don't have your own spy agency? Dang. Man, if you can piggyback off the U.S., you don't really need to worry about it. Save some money.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So what did they have you do then? They got an idea for you.
Yeah. It's basically get close to these people and tell us what they're doing.
Who are these people, though?
So these people are Muslim people who, for whatever reason, have come under some kind of suspicion. They're online and they are in the mosque. And my job is to basically become friends with them or find out what's happening with them. And I'm not told anything. If the service has any information on them, I'm not informed of that. And that is to keep me honest, really, that there's no bias involved, that I just freely report what I'm able to access. So I was really good at my job, and I was able to get in with a lot of people and either verified what the service already knew or denied what others had claimed of this person. So, for example, it was also getting people off of suspicion.
Yeah, sure, because they might be like, you know, I don't like that guy. I kind of want his house. I'm going to tell somebody that he's doing something shady, and he'll get thrown in jail.
Perfect example. There was this imam who was making truckloads of money doing Arabic teaching, Arabic classes online. And other imams who were jealous of him contacted the service and said, this guy's Taliban.
Damn, that sucks. Right?
And it was like, and when it came to me, I was like, what? I was like, that dude is not Taliban.
Okay? No.
He's not Taliban.
Yeah, that's,
and
oh, man,
so,
that's horrible.
And then he's like, and then basically they told me, they're like, okay, well, because a couple of imams are saying that he is. And I was like, those imams are jealous of him that he's making that kind of money and they're not. And they've learned this in their countries, because in those countries, anonymous phone calls do qualify as evidence, and that's
sure.
it. And you'll be disappeared for years.
You hear about that. You hear about that in Iraq and Afghanistan,
absolutely.
Syria.
Happens all the time, right? And so thankfully, we live in a society, and I would hope we would want to live in a society in which you need more than that. You need more than just anonymous phone calls. And so that's where a person like me comes into play.
Yeah, okay. So then they got you on these kids who don't really look all that impressive on paper, right? I've looked at the whole Toronto 18 investigation, and like the mastermind dude just looks like he played a lot of Fortnite. Well, it wasn't Fortnite back then, but he played the equivalent, man, like World of Warcraft or something like that. And this attack plan, well, we'll get into that in a second, but there's like this, the guy sets up a training camp in northern Canada where it looks like kids in snowsuits running around with paintball guns, and they're freezing, they're sleeping in their car. I mean, what was that all about?
Yeah, the Toronto 18 case in 2006, what ended up happening was, it started off with CSIS, them telling me, there's a bunch of guys, tell us what they're up to. Now, CSIS already knew 11 days before they sent me in that these guys had a training camp, quote-unquote, planned. And so I basically became friends with them, and they basically started to try to recruit me, or they were kind of saying, yeah, brother, don't you believe that, you know, the Canadians are a fair target because of their deployments in Afghanistan and because of what the Americans did in Iraq. And since the Canadians are partners to the Americans, again, they're fair game. So this is the general grievance narrative that emerged post-2003, really. I mean, even if you look at the Boston Marathon bombings, the guy literally wrote it in blood in that boat. This is because of Iraq and Afghanistan. So those grievances have played a big part in the things that have happened afterwards. The London subway bombings were a result of that as well, or in retaliation / response. So in this environment, post-2003, these kinds of groups are popping up all over the world. In Australia, there was a similar group. In the UK, in the, you know, the Nordic countries, and now also in Canada. And this is what a lot of Canadians couldn't understand, that there were people like this. Like, what the heck is radicalization? We don't know. It was a relatively, still a very relatively new term. So these guys got involved online. They were fantasizing a lot about this stuff for 5 years. All they did was online companionship, basically fantasizing about wanting to do something. And then in 2005, they decided that enough talk, it's time for action. And a number of things were set in motion. A guy came from the UK, two guys came, you know, in a Greyhound bus from Atlanta, Georgia, up to Toronto, and three guys who were in Toronto. They all met together and they decided, we need to escalate. So this became very aspirational. They had this idea in mind, and that idea was basically commit catastrophic terrorist attacks. Now, a lot of this, them being depicted as these bumbling amateurs, it comes from me because that's what I saw. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm the older guy. I've been exposed to more serious things. Like you said, these guys were kids, and even I've used that term. I mean, they were technically adults in law, but there were four young offenders in law. Like, they were under 18, and they were really kids. Like, this, you know, I made this joke about, you know, one kid who put his shoes too close to the fire. They melted the rubber off of his shoes. Or one guy bringing a spring tent that we were supposed to stay in, and I'm just like, what? Like, how are you going to survive
in the middle
a spring
of winter?
Tent? Like,
yeah, so they're freezing.
You know, and that's why we end up sleeping in the car, because I kept the heater on all night, because these kids, they could die from hypothermia in there. And that's really what, you know, I was thinking about, is like, wait a second, like, it's very unsafe in that sense. So that's what happened. This training camp was held for like 12 days. We went up there and played G.I. Jihadi, basically. But the main thing was this, is that they had some plans, right? Nothing was really, you know, concrete. It was aspirational. Their reach exceeded their grasp. They were not going to succeed in the catastrophic terror attacks that they had envisioned, simply because the group had been sufficiently infiltrated. But the test in law is not whether you can succeed in a catastrophic terrorist attack. the test in law is, do you have a guilty intention?
Mm-hmm.
And have you taken steps to realize that intention? Simple. And so they did. And I mean, that aspect of the law, at least at its basic, you know, core, mens rea and actus reus, that was fulfilled.
Yeah, because they were smuggling guns up or trying to smuggle guns up, had gotten some guns. You at one point had gotten a rifle for them and then you like didn't give it to them.
Oh my
right?
God. This, I mean, it, just to show you how complex and like on the fly things are. So, you know, this is very early on and December 4, 2005. And the guy calls me, you know, he's like, hey, I need you to come. I need to talk to you right now. You need to come right away. So I was like, sure, okay, hopped in my car and drove over. Now, unbeknownst to me, even, he had enrolled in a hunting course. And the instructor had a store in which she was selling this rifle. And he had his eyes on that rifle. But without telling me any of this, he simply said to me, he said, look, we need to go and go shopping for guns. Can you do that? Because they knew that I had a gun license. So I said, without hesitation, I said, sure. So he replies, okay, good. That was a test because some people were saying that you might be a spy.
Hmm. Interesting.
So there you go. So now it was. So now look at how.
Were you worried about that at all? I'd be
well,
like, oh.
Well, let's walk this through.
Yeah.
Because look what ends up happening. The next day, we go gun shopping and we go to three different locations that sold guns. The first one, you know, they looked at us and we were shady as F, and
yeah.
He was just like happy to get us out of there.
Yeah.
The other guy just like, yeah, whatever, didn't care, didn't probably thought we weren't going to buy anything anyway, so whatever. And then we got to the store that the lady owned, where this guy knew exactly the rifle that he wanted. It was a 22 caliber long rifle, Marlin. And then he says to me, he goes, oh, well, here, he pulls out a wad of money and he's like, here's money for, I want that rifle and I want 1,000 rounds of ammunition. Now, what am I supposed to do?
Yeah, you have to buy it.
I have to buy it.
Sure.
But I just bought a gun, a rifle, and 1,000 rounds of ammunition. So I thought to myself, all right, I don't know that he has any other 22 rifles. So I said, I'll keep the rifle and you can keep the bullets. Well, he said I wanted to keep, you know, he wanted both. But I said, no, let me keep the weapon just in case somebody comes to my house to check on it. And so at least I had the rifle, but now
that's
this guy's
quick thinking. Because you have a gun license, maybe they can actually inspect for the
weapon. Exactly, exactly. And so this is the kind of on the fly, you know, by your wits, you know, thinking that you got to do. And what ends up happening, of course, is that I get accused of, well, you're the one that bought the gun. Well, you're the one that facilitated all of this, and it wouldn't have happened without you. So, I mean, that's the thing. And what people don't realize is that they can enlist the assistance of criminals to get illegal guns, like they've done it already. So it's not a far cry that they could have done this elsewhere, right? So basically what ended up happening is I had to give the bad guys, you know, this false story that the intelligence service came to visit my home and they were asking about the rifle. And so when I told this story to them, they were like, oh yeah, that's because of us, because, you know, we're involved in some pretty serious stuff. And so blah, blah, blah. It was like a badge of honor.
Yeah, they think they were being tough.
They're thinking that they, so of course, you know, and then we basically had to come up with a story. I said, okay, look, man, I want to get rid of this rifle. I'm just going to get you your money back. And I don't want to deal with this anymore. But the bullets were still out there. And that's something that at least it was manageable, right?
Sure.
Because the main thing is the rifle itself.
Get the weapon off the street.
Right.
Yeah. And I know that one of the guys had put like a few thousand dollars down supposedly on some guns from Mexico. So like these guys had intent and they were going after it.
Yeah,
they did
successfully bring over at least one gun because that was the one gun that we had with us on the training camp.
Oh, yeah, the handgun.
The handgun, right? And that, of course, turned into it's Mubin's handgun and it's not my handgun. And what's funny is how for a long time, probably to this very day, that we have a lot of Canadian Muslims, especially those who accuse me of entrapment in this case, they think that I'm armed. They think that I have a gun that I carry around all the time. And it's like, guys, I don't. But it's like, all right, well, whatever. I'll let you continue.
Whatever
thinking
keeps
that.
You safe, yeah.
But it just kind of showed how this is what you got to do, right? Like sometimes it's a test. And like if you blow your cover or like you remove that undercover element, they go dark and you lose contact.
Sure, which is scary.
And then you don't know how long it's going to take before something ends up happening. And we don't have the luxury of doing that. So a sting operation manages the close of that investigation by arresting them. And then
what was your plan? Your plan was, or their plan, not your plan, but...
Yeah, so there's some confusion here. So initially, let's call it a large aspirational generic plan.
Right? Okay.
And that is basically blow shit up, all right?
Yeah,
somewhere.
Yeah.
Simple. But then it becomes more specific. So the one really fantasy plot was attack the Parliament building in Canada, in the capital city, Ottawa, take the members of Parliament hostage and begin to cut their heads off one by one and force the eviction of Canadian forces from Afghanistan. We joked about how we would put snipers so that if anyone came, we could obviously take them out. There was another, again, just going through scenarios. Could we have car bombs go off in the city to draw the attention of first responders and distract them while we stormed the Parliament? So that was one plot. But then what happened is the group kind of split because Zakaria Amara basically began to think that Fahim Ahmed was a big bullshitter.
So one of the guys thought the other leader was just kind of full of crap. Yeah.
It's very similar to a gang scenario where it's like, don't follow that guy. I'm going to be the leader now, right? I'm the captain now. And then what happened is he basically took a smaller group of guys and they developed a plan to detonate 3 1-ton ammonium nitrate truck bombs. The Oklahoma City bombing, the Murrah building, that's what a 1-ton ammonium nitrate truck bomb does. It takes the whole half of the building right out. So that was their intent. And they thought of 3 locations. The first one was the CSIS building, the intelligence office. Of course, underneath it, so if you were to put that bomb on that road, it wouldn't just take out the building above it. It would take out the pedestrian pathway beneath it. The Toronto Stock Exchange was the second target. And also, one of the guys wanted to make false investments, fraudulent investments,
and
make money off of that attack.
To, like, short the market and then profit.
The third target was an Air Force base where our fallen soldiers are repatriated because of the psychological impact of killing your guys a second time. And so that's what it ended up becoming.
Wow. Jeez. So that is really like despicable plan.
They would not succeed in this attack.
It's a complicated attack. You're going to attack the intelligence headquarters. I mean, no one's looking for that kind of chatter and everything.
Exactly. You know, one does not simply come up with one ton of ammonium nitrate.
Right? Hey, Amazon. Oh, go on Amazon and order every bag of ammonium nitrate that you can find.
Well, what they did, they thought they were smart, but they created a false company called Student Farmers. And they printed t-shirts and business cards and a website because, you know, that's all it takes, right?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, you don't think they're looking for people ordering 1 ton of ammonium nitrate?
Sir, someone just ordered 1 ton of ammonium nitrate. Well, check them out. Well, they did print t-shirts that said they were Student Farmers. Right. Nah, that's fine. Let them have it.
So we do laugh at it because it's like it's impossible that they could have succeeded. The seriousness to me is what they fantasized.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure. What they saw happening in their head was just macabre is what it was. It was macabre.
If they couldn't have gotten the fertilizer because the order got dinged and they didn't get arrested, they would have just figured, you can go to the mall with a bunch of swords and start hacking people up and you can still do damage. I mean, at some point, you're just going to do something horrible.
Well, and that's a good point because, I mean, what does happen, right? When they realize that, well, I can't achieve that, well, they just completely abandon all plans whatsoever?
Yeah. Guess I'll go to college now. No.
Exactly, exactly. Because even we know, I mean, certainly the Americans know, like just one pistol, 15 rounds. I mean, how many people you can kill with
that? Yeah, sure.
Right? Or more pistols or a long rifle with 900 rounds of ammunition.
Yeah, start a fire at a stadium. What's full of people?
Even though that was a plot that they could not have pulled off, they could very easily have just dropped down a few notches and, you know, taking the loss and go with a less spectacular attack, but still kill people. So they certainly were of that mentality, right?
I do wonder, though, when you guys were at that camp, weren't locals kind of surprised that a bunch of like super Islamic looking dudes are hanging out in the woods and then like popping into Tim Hortons every few hours to pee and get a drink?
Yeah, that was really funny because there was actually we went to this No Frills to get, I think, tuna. And it was like we were in like Whitey McWhiteville, you know, and like these brown bearded camo wearing. When we walked in, it's like you could hear the pin drop and like the necks just go, like, what is this? It became public knowledge afterwards that, in fact, the police had told the neighbors they are being watched and don't engage them, don't confront them. There was this like hermit dude who kept coming out and saying, hey guys, what's going on? And just like totally, he seemed like he was just spaced all the time, like out of it.
Super high.
I don't know what it was, but he was just like, hey, guys. Because, you know, sometimes a UFO lands over there and, like, he just really got us going.
Oh, he's mentally...
Yeah, there was, I don't know what, but, you know, he was just this really, this eccentric figure who was a local. He just didn't bother us. There were some snowmobilers who were kind of like, hey, what are you guys doing here? You know, this is like Joe McDonald's land. Not realizing, like, we were basically squatting on this guy's property, but... They were basically told, just leave it alone, we're watching this, and carry on.
Wow. They must have been, yeah, so they knew, oh, man, that's the biggest thing to ever happen up there in northern Canada. Sure.
Absolutely.
So you bust this plot wide open, the kids get arrested, there's a video of it, we can link it in the show notes. They basically, they're like unloading all these fake bags of ammonium nitrate, which are probably rock salt or something, and then these armed SWAT cops come in and bust these dudes in student farmer t-shirts, which...
coveralls.
Damn it, the t-shirts didn't work. Your dad finds out because he sees you on TV.
Yeah, I actually told him in advance. Tell him before that show aired, because he does watch that show religiously. And I did tell him right before the show
started. Wait, he watched which show?
It was called The Fifth Estate.
Is it like a news show?
Yeah, it's like your 60 Minutes or W5.
Oh, right on.
Like, yeah. I basically told him, I was like, listen, you heard about the arrest that happened of all those guys? Because the arrest happened early June, and I gave my interview in July, basically. And so I said, listen, you heard about these arrests. I'm the undercover on that case. And he just looked at me, and he was just like, Alhamdulillah, you know, all praise due to God. Tell them to give you a full-time job now. that was his thinking,
and
right?
They did.
Right? So I was like, what? Well.
That was the first thing he said?
That was the first thing he said. He was like, tell them to give you a job. Alhamdulillah. I think he then very quickly realized, wait a second, because now that it became very public, the impact of that started to be felt.
Sure.
You know, he is so respected in the community that I think maybe, I'm sure a few people did tell him that, hey, your son, what your son did was not good.
Yeah.
And he just didn't tell me.
Sure.
To hurt, you know, so not to hurt my feelings. But he claims that most people said that what your son did was right and, you know, you should be proud of him.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. And he's got such cred in the community that nobody even tried to blacklist him. Like, they totally blacklisted me. Don't get me wrong. To this day, I get
you're like not invited to the wedding.
I'm persona non grata in a lot of these things, right? Which is fine with me because I don't have time for their biryani dinners and, you know, where they backbite about other people. Like, I don't got time for that.
You have five kids. You don't have time for anything.
I got my own life and things happening. So. But they didn't even try to do that to him. And I think one of the reasons why I didn't get whacked is because the people who could basically call for me to get whacked know my dad very, very well.
Yeah. Ooh,
and they'd just be like, no, it's bad what he did and we don't agree with it and he ruined these kids' lives. But, you know, he didn't kill anybody and whatever. So
I mean, you didn't ruin their lives.
They ruined their own lives.
They would have died in that attack.
Well,
so.
They wouldn't have even been able to succeed in that attack. Or even if they would have, you know, moved on to some other attack, maybe less of a spectacle, but still lethal. Again, like, that was irrelevant to me. Those are all secondary factors to me. It's like, this is what you want to do in a city that I'm born and raised in. In the name of my religion, right? I'm not going to allow that to happen. I don't care what people say. Those things alone, that you want to blow shit up in my home and use my religion as a cover, not acceptable.
Yeah, not on my watch, right?
I'll end your life if I have to.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Mubeen Sheikh. We'll be right back after this.
This episode is sponsored in part by HostGator.
People always ask us how many business cards they should get printed before their next big networking event, and we tell them the same thing every time. Business cards may have been a state-of-the-art way to connect in 1957, but you know what's truly timeless here in 2019? Having your own website. I'm not talking about Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, MySpace, or whatever social media accounts you've collected over the years. I'm talking about a website you can call your very own and share with the people in your network. You may cringe at the idea because it sounds like something that's A, expensive, B, complicated, and C, a lot of work to maintain. But our friends at HostGator know a thing or two about making the process simple from start to finish because they've been helping people just like you since 2002. HostGator's 99.9% uptime guarantee and around-the-clock support ensures your website is available to the eyes of the world every day and night of the year. Got a tight budget? No worries. As long as you're a new user, you get to try any HostGator package for up to 62% off the normal price just for hearing the sound of my voice. And if you're not completely satisfied with everything HostGator has to offer, you've got 45 days to cancel for a refund of every last penny. Check out HostGator.com/Jordan right now to sign up. That's HostGator.com/Jordan.
This episode is also sponsored by NetSuite. If you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. And the problem that a lot of growing businesses have that keeps them from knowing their numbers is this hodgepodge of business systems. And they have one system for accounting, another one for sales, another one for inventory. So there's a lot of time, a lot of resources that are being taken up. NetSuite is actually something that we used at our old companies. This is a crazy, amazing business management software. It handles every aspect of your business in a cloud platform. So you get visibility, you get control, and you can obsess over your numbers like we were doing back in the day and still are, frankly. You save time, you save money, you save a lot of unneeded headaches by managing sales, finance, accounting, orders, HR, right from your desktop, right from your phone. It is the number one cloud business system. This is like a real legit enterprise level solution. And if you have a small business, you should look into this as well, because right now they're giving you an insights guide that actually isn't just a bunch of like fluffy content marketing. There's some good insights in there and stuff I certainly wish I had when I started my business. Jason?
Right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights with a free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits at netsuite.com/Jordan. That's netsuite.com/Jordan to download your free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits, netsuite.com/Jordan.
This episode is also sponsored in part by Kettlebell Kitchen. I tried these meals. These are like healthy, right? Because of course, a lot of these meals that come to your door, they say they're healthy, but they're really not. And they're made by a nutritionist and they're like, yeah, these are healthy because they're under, I don't know, 400 calories. Kettlebell Kitchen is different. They've got really good jerk chicken. That's the one that sticks out in my mind. But everything I've tried from them has been pretty delish so far. Founded by veterans, their goal is to help you achieve your goals. They've got meal plans that are tailored to your needs. There's a whole team of nutritionists that will help you create sustainable health plans, honors your body's unique needs. So if you're on the vegetarian thing, cool, they got you. Keto, they got you. Whole30, paleo, they got you. So you can even filter by calorie, protein, fat, and carb limits so you get your macros. You get exactly the right food for whatever kind of diet you're on, whatever your body needs are. And it's delivered to your door twice a week, so it's fresh. It's not like stuff arrives on Monday and you're eating it on Saturday and Sunday, just like sawing through it with a hacksaw. It's not like that. You get your macros covered, you get fresh stuff, and you can feed the champion in you with $25 off each of your first two orders for new customers. Kettlebellkitchen.com. Use the code Jordan at checkout. Kettlebellkitchen.com. Enter code Jordan for $25 off each of your first two orders for new customers. Enjoy that and let me know which ones you like best, and I'll try those next time as well.
Thanks for listening and supporting the show. Your support of our advertisers keeps us on the air. So to learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard so you can check out those amazing sponsors, visit jordanharbinger.com/deals. And don't forget the worksheet for today's episode. That link is in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. If you're listening to us on the Overcast player, please click that little star next to the episode. We really appreciate it. Now for the conclusion of our episode with Mubin Shake.
Well, another thing that surprises a lot of people is that all this radicalization thing, this hits all social strata. It's not like broke-ass, poor people nowhere. There are people that go over there where you're like, wait a minute, your dad's a lawyer, your mom's like a surgeon.
Yep, middle class, educated, they have stuff. You know, it's funny, I do this presentation because I train U.S. Special Forces now on ISIS, especially those who are, you know, going to deploy. And I have this whole section, and on one of my sections, I have these photos of food pictures that ISIS guys were posting.
I noticed that. I was searching on Twitter, and I was like, I was looking for what jihadis were talking about. A lot of it's in Arabic or whatever. I can't read it. And then I look at stuff, and I'm like, is that a kebab? What is that a freaking shawarma-looking sandwich? It was funny to me because I'm thinking, okay, there's a lot of pictures of food, but what's going on here? ISIS members are freaking talking about the pictures of their lunch in Raqqa. Like, it's like jihad meets like some hipster from Brooklyn, like some guy from my high school who now is making bespoke kombucha in his apartment in Williamsburg. And yet these guys are also like, they're like, we're going to blow up and shoot a bunch of stuff. Also, we have kebabs. Yeah. Look at this fresh goat we just slaughtered. It was just everybody takes pictures of their food, even ISIS.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in those days, what was happening is they were trying to recruit people to get them over and join their lands. And people were afraid that, am I going to be able to eat the way that I ate? So they would put out these recruiting posters. It's like, kebabs? Yeah, we got that. And there's a picture of nice kebabs, you know what I mean? And then it's like, how can I not take a picture of that? And it's like a milkshake. And then they have like Frappuccino from Starbucks, or Nutella was a big thing. There was like this whole thing with ISIS and Nutella. Like, your listeners right now, if you were just to go and Google that, go and Google that right now. ISIS and Nutella, you'll see the kind of stuff that came up. And in one of those pictures was really, like you said, cutting across social strata, this Indo-Pakistani, so like, you know, Indian subcontinent, in the UK, British citizen, in Syria, referring to pizza as home food. He's like, home food, how I missed you, and it's pizza.
Wow, the irony, man.
Right? And it's like, but what that told you is, these guys, these people, they are products of the society they grew up in. They can front all they want and wave their placards and their flags and their slogans, but you are products of the West.
Yeah.
If I can flip the script a bit, there's a woman, female, who admitted, she said that all I wanted to do was get my piece of eye candy. And basically she was...
Oh, she went there first.
She didn't even go there. She was watching these jihadi videos and seeing these guys with long hair, big guns, and the phrase she used was, I wanted to get my piece of eye candy. And we laughed because it's like, we use that phrase. That is a purely Western phrase. You know, it kind of also shows you that these are young kids or maybe young adults who have been told to suppress their sexuality, where they can't even interact with members of the opposite sex without it being framed under marriage or virgins in heaven after you blow yourselves up. It's like, dude, just get a girlfriend right here on earth.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So, you preferred. Yeah, definitely. What type of people get radicalized, though? Like, are there...
All backgrounds. Male, female, rich, poor.
Yeah.
You name it. White, black, Asian.
You've got these four factors, though, like geopolitics or ideology, money, adventure, frustration. Can you talk about that a little? You don't have to go into too much detail, but that was an interesting combo.
I mean, basically, there's always a multiplicity of factors. There's a great quote by Peter Neumann. He's the founder of the International Center for the Study of Radicalization. It says, ideology without grievances doesn't resonate, and grievances without ideology are not acted upon. All right, one more time. Ideology without grievances doesn't resonate, and grievances without ideology are not acted upon. Another quote that's mine is, sometimes religious ideology is indeed a driver for violent extremism, but at other times, just a passenger with other psychosocial factors at the wheel.
Okay.
And so that will include then your sense of meaning and belonging, needs. The geopolitics falls under the grievances, mm-hmm. So wars that are happening in different lands. Because people ask, you know, why do they hate us? Well, you've been bombing them for decades and decades. You're destroying their societies. So what do you think is going to emerge from those societies, if not extremist thinking?
Yeah, right? Of course. Right? So, the frustration, the geopolitics, and the ideology.
Exactly, right? So these are the things that relate to, and why I put, you know, like poverty, for example, people say sometimes poverty is a factor, other times it's not a factor. What you got to look at is every individual in their context and look at every factor relative to that individual in that context. So ideology could be prevalent for some people and it just be a secondary factor for somebody else or for some other people.
Right. Like some people who have nothing might go for the money because they're just like, whatever.
That's right.
But other people are going, no, I'm here for the ideology. I don't care about the money. But also the adventure's kind of cool because I'm 18 and I'm bored off my ass.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
That makes
the opportunity to go from zero to hero overnight.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
How intriguing, how enticing is that for a young person who sees himself as a zero, right? Just living at home, doing nothing.
What can we look for? Our parents or friends, like, what am I looking for if I'm like, is this person doing some radical weird stuff? Like, maybe I wouldn't have somebody like that in my circle, but maybe there's like a Muslim kid or a Muslim parent who's like, my kid is being weird. They're on the internet. I don't know what they're doing.
Right.
What do they look for?
Yeah, it's a very, very good question. Very timely. You know, sudden changes in behavior are the biggest warning sign,
mm-hmm.
and especially extreme changes. Now, just because, you know, your daughter comes home with a hijab, or, you know, your son decides he's going to convert and wants to grow a beard, that in and of itself is not a sign of extremism. You have to look at clusters of behaviors. So when you start looking at unequivocal black and white thinking, especially where you begin to demonize others,
mm-hmm.
so it's like believers and disbelievers and kuffar. Well, now it's like you're really demonizing people who don't believe in your religion, right? It's something to say, oh, they don't believe in my religion, right? Like, okay, we have a difference. Versus anyone who does not believe what I believe is going to hell.
Yeah.
Right? Now, even that, that's like, you could say even, that's extreme conservative thinking. So let's look at more clusters. And really, ideology is going to be a big kicker in that. As soon as you start to justify or sympathize with certain activities or certain actions or saying, well, you know, this is okay what they're doing because then now you're starting to get into sympathy and then that starts to lead into membership. So you might obviously look to see, I mean, is this person carrying around ISIS paraphernalia or is it Al-Qaeda paraphernalia or I don't even know what that is. Who do I call?
Yeah.
Right? So if I can just give a quick shout out and open plug-in to a group called Parents for Peace. They're at parentsforpeace.org. There is a line for parents, a 1-800 number that they can call where there are people that will actually talk to you. So there is some assistance in that regard for that. But really, like I said, ideology is the big one. Look to see what sect that they are either converting to or, you know, something along those lines. And that will be a good start in terms of seeing what your kid is actually up to. Because the last thing you want is the FBI basically breaking down your door and hauling your kid out.
So you talk to some of these extremists online right now and try to kind of debunk their BS. Is that one of your hobbies now, I guess? I don't know.
Yeah, basically what happened is after like the Toronto 18 court cases were done in 2010 and this whole ISIS thing really started to kick up in 2012 and lasted for a number of years.
Yeah.
And in those years, what I was doing from 2012, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17, I was online every day with these people trying to engaging them, directly engaging them, trolling them, responding to them, using, you know, Islamic sources to counter their deviant interpretations, training government agencies in trying to do the same thing, obviously not to the level that I was doing. So I did do that for several years, day in and day out. I stopped doing that because I just got fed up with it, to be honest, right? It took so much out of my soul, you know, that like, because they're so needy. They require so much because they're, especially those who are young kids, like the young recruits and ideologues or, you know, professed acolytes of ISIS, they were just like hours and hours of the day. And I'm an adult. I have a life. I have a family. I have like things that I got to do. And it's like, they just sucked up so much of my time, right? So I did do that for a while, but, you know, ISIS was, you know, largely defeated. I'm going to put that in air quotes. Because they're not defeated. They are going to rise again. They've just kind of gone into hiding and laying low until a more opportune moment. But that is what I did in that time, yeah.
I mean, a lot of these people are loners with like no friends that are finding their community online. So yeah, you going, yeah. Hey, look, I got to go eat dinner with my kids. They're like, well, I'm going to be online for another 7 hours because I have nothing to do.
I would do that deliberately. You know, I would say to them because I would make them wait for me to come back.
Yeah.
Because they were like dying. That's all they do. They were online all the time. And it's like, oh, okay, well, I have a life now, so I'm going to go and I'll be back in a few hours, you know, and just kind of tease them like that. So,
what's the volume of discussion and recruiting? Is it like hundreds of people or is it like thousands of people are online recruiting kids for ISIS?
Now the whole recruiting for ISIS thing has plummeted is really the word. In 2012, when it just started to kick off, 2014 is really when it started, 2015... It escalated. The attacks began, ISIS attacks. The first ISIS attacks happened really at the beginning of 2014, but late 2014, because mid-2014 is when they declared their caliphate, or their caliphate, as I call it. And then 2015 was even more. 2016 was more than that. 2017 was more than that. And then by 2018, it started to come down. So those are the years in which it really starts to peak. And what they were doing, and there have been some studies done on this as well, on how they... You know, amazing use of technology, use of bots.
Yeah.
They did that hijacking hashtags. So they would come on World Cup during World Cup and ISIS and beheading video. And then you who's kind of scrolling through, it's like, oh, ISIS beheading video. Oh, let me check that out. Da, da, da. And then you go further down the rabbit hole. So this was like a trawling almost, right? That they were doing. So there were thousands of recruiters, but a lot of them were bots.
Oh, interesting. Okay?
So there were a core group of recruiters who were putting messaging out. That messaging was being amplified by followers, by electronic account, like bot accounts. It did spread far and wide in that time, what's interesting is that we kind of watched how social media gave platform to these people and allowed them to recruit openly in many cases. And it frustrated the hell out of me that this was allowed to happen, that kids are being recruited, like it's happening. Here, look, go and watch and see it happen. But what's funny is that I spoke to a CIA friend of mine who said basically, if we just turned out the lights, then they would just go dark and we wouldn't know where they're going, who they're going with, where they're staying. Allowing these guys to talk, it's like, okay, a few dozen people get recruited. But you know what this does is it opens up the door for hundreds of them to be compromised. So
you can monitor and try to trace back.
And so that's what ended up happening. So that's what happened with the whole recruiting thing anyway.
How do you de-radicalize? I mean, you kind of did it by seeing the September 11th attacks, going to Syria, learning stuff. It's kind of hard to go, oh, you know, some of your beliefs are wrong. You should do this multi-year self-education so that you make sure that you're right and find out that you're not.
You know, I liken attempts to de-radicalize people like trying to convince somebody to change their political stripe.
Yeah.
Think about how difficult that is.
So almost impossible.
It is. And that is what you're looking at with de-radicalization. Now, unfortunately, in this context now, we're dealing with a lot of individuals who are in custody or have been arrested. And so that de-radicalization option is really under coercion, right? And so it's hard to know if they're sincere about it.
Yeah.
How do you know? And I've taken recently a harder line on de-radicalization. It is not a magic bullet. It's not something that it's assumed or automatic or whatever. It's extremely difficult. And one of the things, like I'll mention only, you know, some things because I don't want to give away all, because these guys will deceive you.
Right? Yeah,
they will tell you what you think you want to hear so that you will give them the check mark of de-radicalized and then maybe get a lesser sentence and maybe get out sooner. But, you know, basically you have to look to see, you know, the changes in ideology, right? Change in religious practice, right? How do they see Islam? How do they view the world? How do they view those who are not like them? There are nuances that you want to be able to look at. And really the best way to do this is using former extremists like myself. Even in some cases in Germany, they have, because in Germany, the de-radicalization of white supremacists is actually what began this whole de-radicalization thing. Hmm. It was in Germany in the 80s where people were leaving neo-Nazi groups, and then the principles of that were now transferred over to jihadists. And so in Germany, you have an ex-white supremacist who actually counsels jihadists.
That's got to be an odd couple hanging out.
It just kind of shows you. So now we're doing a, you know, we're trying to get a more formalized system in place. You know, my friend, our mutual friend, Brandon Blackburn, you know, we've been actually trying to work with State Department to train other countries how to conduct de-radicalization and how to conduct training for some of these government agencies. Because a lot of the Middle Eastern countries, there are tens of thousands of foreign fighters who are going to return back.
Yeah.
I actually do have like the most up-to-date numbers for the U.S.
on how many foreign fighters
there
are.
Yeah, actually, if you got a second here,
I'll give you the time.
This is actually the freshest information available right now. So 300 in total tried or succeeded going to Iraq or Syria, Americans.
From the United States. Wow.
18 are back. 11 males who were charged, 2 males who were not charged, plus 2 females who were charged and 3 females who were not charged. So 13 males and 5 females. At least, in addition, okay, so that's 18, plus at least 13 children.
That they've had over there.
That are back.
Oh, that are back.
Yep.
Oh, wow.
So
like hundreds of people.
So that's what you're dealing with in the U.S. These are relatively low numbers. I mean, the U.S. is so far away. Just like Canada, we're dealing with fewer numbers. I mean, I think there's like 30-some-odd in custody right now. 6 who are men, 9 who are women, and 17 who are children, most that are under the age of 5. Those are small numbers. Now you start to go over to the Middle Eastern countries where you're dealing with thousands of people.
Wow.
Germany, Belgium, even Europeans, because it's very close proximity. And so for them, they were able to go. So that's the situation we're dealing with now, facing the prospect of these individuals going back to those countries and basically waiting to see what happens in the next few years if they kick off.
What kind of programs are there for jihadists who come back to their home country and are like, all right, I should probably de-radicalize? Or they're not even thinking that. They're just like, I'll chill in America because this ISIS thing's not working out. Syria's a mess.
Well, the U.S. is really good in the sense that their material support of terrorism charge is very broad and allows them very easy prosecutions in that regard. Other countries, not so much. Canada is struggling. The UK is struggling, especially Commonwealth nations. Australia are struggling to charge these individuals because it's very difficult to get evidence of war crimes in a war zone.
Sure.
In a lot of these cases, these individuals are not being charged at all.
Does everybody need to be charged? I mean, look, maybe I'm naive, but some of these people are just dumbass 18-year-old kids.
Well, probably, yeah.
Wow, I'm so glad I'm not there anymore. That place sucked.
Well, we need a triage process to determine who those people are. Because I submit that it is a colossal failure of our legal system that we can't charge these people. Because you're basically telling them you got off. You got off of being part of a, you know, raping, mass murdering terrorist group. And what message does that send to people? Does it dissuade them? I don't know.
Of course not.
It's not going to dissuade them. They're going to think they're protected by Allah because the kuffar can't touch me.
Oh,
you know, I killed, I shed blood, and nobody can charge me? I mean, that's like, so why would we go out of our way to repatriate these people? At least in the U.S., they're getting significant jail time, well, in some cases. I mean, there is one guy who was captured by the Kurds in Syria, and he was like a total like dumbass, okay? Like the way that he spoke, like you could see like his Arabic wasn't good. Like he would be somebody that I score low on the threat and risk scale. He got 20 years.
Oh, jeez.
And
that's
20 years
time.
In a U.S. federal prison.
Yeah.
That's an appropriate sentence in my view.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, in some cases, like in Canada, we had a pretty big one, like 9 years given to one guy. I was actually surprised at that case. That was one of the higher sentences given. But a lot of these other guys, they're getting just not even getting charged, right? We have a guy who came back. He was part of a New York Times podcast called Caliphate by Rukmini Kalimaki.
Yeah,
just fantastic.
So interesting.
Fantastic.
We'll link to it in the show notes.
Yeah, great. Because I'm featured in, I think, episode 5.
Are you? Oh, yeah, so yeah, I've already heard you. I didn't even know.
Yeah, yeah. But Abu Huzaifa, the Canadian who is featured in that, the guy admitted to killing two people.
Yeah, I know.
And we know who he is and this and that. And he wasn't charged. Nothing, right? And in fact, he bragged about how the kuffar can't touch me, this, that, and the other. So that's the dilemma that we face, right? And so some of these people, truly, if we want to bring them to justice, that means holding them accountable for the crimes that they committed, not just crimes that we can charge them with, that we can prove in a court of law.
Yeah, I feel you. I mean, look, it's a different game, right? It's a war. Yeah. Are you worried at all about retaliation now that extremist groups, you know, you've sent some of them to prison, you are actively trying to foil their terror plots. That's never a good way to make friends. You're online messing with their recruiting efforts. Like, are you worried about these people at all?
Look, I do use, you know, ghosting software, government issue ghosting software. So basically hide my locations and whatnot. And they did in those years anyway when I was that active. They have put out warnings against me on their Facebook pages. Yes, they had Facebook pages that were eventually shut down. They actively tried to find out where I was. And even on Twitter, they were trying to, they would post photos of some poor sucker's backyard in New Jersey because that's where my, you know, my IP address showed my location to be. So I do take steps to avoid detection by them. And the agencies are also watching out for me.
Sure,
so
yeah.
I'm not too worried.
Well, thank you for your work keeping us safe. And good luck. We'll see you on Netflix, hopefully.
Yeah, yeah. I want to give a shout out to FusionIntel.com, of course.
Yeah.
Brandon and I have been doing a lot of good work. In fact, I would like to say, you know, one of a high priority mission that we are working on now is to actually repatriate one of these children back to the custody of her father from which she was stolen and taken and basically kidnapped to join ISIS and has been, you know, captured by the Kurds. So that's what we're doing nowadays.
Man, I saw on Vice there was a guy whose wife bounced while he was on a business trip.
Uh-huh.
She apparently died in airstrike. But the kids, there's people who say they're alive, but then when they go interrogate people at the refugee camps, they get, oh, they're over there. Oh, they're dead. And so now they're thinking they're alive. They're just being hidden. It's heartbreaking because this guy is like a taxi driver or something. Went on a trip to visit somebody and then comes back and his wife's like, well, you didn't want to join me. Kids are gone.
Yeah.
And, you know, you video chatted with them for a while.
There's all kinds of these stories.
Horrifying.
And unfortunately, that's just the mess that ISIS left for everybody. So.
Well, thanks for doing your part and help to clean it up,
man. Thank you,
man.
I really appreciate it. Cheers.
Thanks to Mubin for coming on the show. We're going to look for him on Netflix or something thereabouts. Hopefully that'll wrap up soon and we'll get to watch a little bit of his work in a fictionalized format, of course. Of course, there's a video of this interview on our YouTube channel at jordanharbinger.com/YouTube. And there are worksheets for every episode, so you can review what you've learned from Mubin at jordanharbinger.com in the show notes. And if you want to know how I create a network that gets me amazing guests like Mubin, check out 6-Minute Networking. It's our course. It's free. It's over at jordanharbinger.com/course. The number one mistake I see people make when it comes to personal or business networking is just not digging the well before you get thirsty. Once you need relationships, you're too late to build them. So get on it. Dig that well before you get thirsty. The drills take 6 minutes per day. Not even. 5-minute networking was taken. So it's 6-minute networking. JordanHarbinger.com/course. And by the way, most of the guests on the show, the people you hear, they subscribe to the course in the newsletter. A lot of them come from my replies. So join us. You'll be in smart company. Speaking of building relationships, you can reach out and or follow me on social. I'm at Jordan Harbinger on both Twitter and Instagram. This show is created in association with Podcast One. This episode was produced by Jen Harbinger, Jason DeFilippo, and edited by Jace Sanderson. Show notes and worksheets by Robert Fogarty. Music by Evan Viola, and I'm your host, Jordan Harbinger. Our advice and opinions and those of our guests are their own. And yeah, I'm a lawyer, but I'm not your lawyer. So do your own research before implementing anything you hear on the show. And remember, we rise by lifting others. The fee for the show is that you share it with friends when you find something useful or interesting, which should be in every episode. So please share the show with those you love and even those you don't. In the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so you can live what you listen. And we'll see you next time.